The Athletic.
Welcome to day three of the World Cup here in Qatar. Coming up, we'll take a deep dive into the standout performance so far as England routed Iran 6-2. So the goals flowed, the games came thick and fast, and that steps up today with the first day of four matches, including Lionel Messi kicking off his final World Cup. But the controversy off the field shows no signs of abating. I'm Adam Leventhal, and this is the Athletic Football Podcast.
Wilson in on goal, playing in Grealish. England have six in a game for a second World Cup in a row.
Well, with me today is The Athletic's two England writers, Jack Pitt-Brook and Oliver Kay, who were both there to see the demolition of Iran yesterday. I was at Netherlands against Senegal, thanks to two late goals, including one from rising star Cody Gakpo. You can read all about him on The Athletic's radar. Jack, let's start off with you. You've sort of pulled apart that performance, and you were impressed by England, but not necessarily enthused. Is that fair enough?
I thought England were good. I thought they were very patient and efficient, and then they were ruthless. They scored basically all of their attacks. I just don't think that... I think some people have looked at the scoreline and thought this was a new buccaneering England playing a new way, and Gareth Southgate finally pushed down the handbrake, just like we've been calling him to do. That wasn't really my sense of the game at all. I just thought that England took all their chances and came up against a team which was frankly provided a lot less resistance than many people expected them to. So I thought England were really good, but I just don't think they were quite as different as people might think.
We're on a rooftop location here in the centre of Doha, so you may well hear occasionally a few helicopters flying over. Ollie, from your point of view, maybe I was being a bit harsh that Jack wasn't enthused about it. Was it just a conservative, efficient performance from Gareth Southgate and that's what we should expect?
I would say it went beyond efficient. I thought it was very impressive, very front foot. I would agree with Jack. It wasn't necessarily sort of like a dramatic change in what they were trying to do. I think just what they were trying to do worked a lot better. Maybe that's partly the standard of the opposition, or maybe the opposition froze. But I think most of us beforehand were looking at Iran's record over the last 4 years and more, particularly their record at the last World Cup, their record in qualifying. They don't concede many goals. Everyone seemed to be expecting a bit of a slog. And yet, from the first minute, England were really sort of trying to pin them back, absolutely dominating possession, and making life very difficult for them, pressing to win the ball back. So I thought even before that stoppage of whatever it was, 8 or 9 minutes for the injury to the goalkeeper, I thought England were really trying to exert some real pressure and looking like scoring right from the start. So I thought, yes, it was highly efficient, but I also felt it was very encouraging in the way, you know, in that sort of proactive, assertive, authoritative way that they started.
And that's the way to start a tournament, isn't it? It doesn't matter who you're playing ultimately. If you can get on the pitch, score goals, give minutes to more squad members than you would, you know, ideally have planned for, and they can come on and score as well, it ticks so many boxes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think this was one of the things that was most impressive, was that England have traditionally started World Cups very badly. Like, they look nervous, they look a bit overawed by the occasion. In 2002 against Sweden, 1-0 up, kind of collapsed in the second half, drew 1-1. 2006 against Paraguay, unwatchable 1-0 win. 2010, 1-1 draw with the USA, the Rob Green mistake, of course. 2014, lost to Italy. 2018, scraped past Tunisia in the last second. But this time, actually, they didn't look... I thought it, in no sense were they kind of overawed by playing the occasion. You know, they went out there and they executed their game plans in a very clear-headed way, which, given everything that's been going on for this week, and obviously, you know, what England players have been going through compares in no way whatsoever to what the Iranian players have been going through, so I don't want to draw any kind of equivalence there, but there has been a lot of sound around the England camp, and I thought that the England players actually went out and played as if it were any other game, and that was one of the... When I said efficient, that's one of the things that I meant, was that they didn't get distracted by anything other than playing the match.
Did you feel that Iran's heads were completely there, and you would be it'd be understandable if they weren't.
Well, the performance wasn't good. I think Carlos Queiroz, the coach, said afterwards how difficult it had been, and he was saying how the sort of lack of enthusiasm among the Iranian fans for the national anthem might have contributed to that, which, to be honest, didn't sound to be the case at all, because, his own players didn't seem to sing the national anthem. They were making their own protest. And yes, it did seem that perhaps their heads weren't there, or their heads weren't quite on it. But it's sometimes those things can galvanise a team, pull them together. But, that didn't really seem to be the case. And I think in that situation, they could probably have done with a more forgiving opponent. England were not forgiving yesterday. England were very, very good and made them look very poor.
We'll talk a little bit more about the Iran situation and some of the off-the-field issues a little bit later on. But Jack, from your point of view, in the lineup, the way that England played, technically, let's get in depth in how they were actually fitting together. Did it show you anything different? Did it show you something that had been worked on in particular, or was it a similar trend to the performances, not necessarily the results, but the performances that you'd seen in the build-up to this World Cup? Because they haven't been good, have they?
No, they haven't been good. This was definitely the best they played for a long time. It barely even needs to be said. They haven't really won a competitive game, I think, since they beat San Marino just over a year ago now. And this was obviously very much harder game than San Marino away. I thought that, the formation was kind of something we've seen from England before. It was the 4-2-3-1. Like, tactically, it was very similar to how they started the Euros last summer, with Mount as the 10. They obviously had Saka in the team this time instead of Foden. But in that sense, it was what we've seen before. What I really thought made the difference was Bellingham. This was Bellingham's first tournament start for England. He had a bit of a role at the last Euros, but this was a new stage for him. And I thought he just gave England something extra because, at the Euros last summer, they had Calvin Phillips next to Declan Rice in the middle of the pitch. And Phillips is, there's lots of stuff that he's really good at, but he's not someone who gets in the box and scores goals. Whereas Bellingham, his header was such a brilliant goal because it's not something you normally get from a sitting midfielder. Storming into the box, getting Luke Shaw puts the cross in, and you've got one of your two number sixes pushed slightly further than that, but you've got one of your two guys who sit in the middle of the pitch who's there to head it in. It reminded me of like a sort of young Michael Ballack, the way that he you don't normally get guys that play in that position who can be that dominant in the air. I thought that was a fantastic goal. And Bellingham's range, his ability to drive forward through the middle of the pitch, his technical skill, he's such a fantastic player that he really elevates what England can do, I think.
We spoke prior to the tournament. We were sort of just ultimately excited about what he might offer. For him to deliver in that first game with the first goal, with an energetic performance, really does just make you think, hang on a minute, this might be the extra marginal gain that England need.
Yeah, well, he obviously was in the squad for the Euros, but he and came on and made a decent eye-catching impression in a few of the games. But he sort of just under 18 months on, he looks a far more mature, assured player, more confident player, and he does really look. I think when we were talking before the tournament, I think everybody expected him to start. Everybody was demanding that he would start. Gareth Southgate was clearly completely convinced of that after the way he performed in the Nations League games in September. He was one of the few players that really caught the eye there. You saw it yesterday, not only with a goal, which was, as Jack said, it was like something you'd see from Michael Ballack or somebody like that. But it was that kind of performance. He was getting his foot in at one end and just charging forward. Not charging forward, that doesn't mean a disservice. Getting forward, timing his runs really well, linking the play, breaking up the play, intercepting. He's just a very, very good all-round midfielder. I don't think he's 10 out of 10 for anything, but I think he's somebody who's just very, very good in every department, and I think he gives England something that, as Jack says, they didn't have at the last tournament, or well, the last two tournaments, but to be honest, I don't think England have had for years.
Somebody said on Twitter that they when I said that header was a bit like Ballack, they said it was a bit like Steven Gerrard's header in the 2005 Champions League final.
Yeah. Technically, it was. Yeah, it was very good. But you didn't see Gerrard very often scoring that type of goal. Gerrard's drives would very often be sort of to the edge of the box and almost hang back a bit. But that was a real. I mean, it was a lovely goal.
In that sense, it was actually almost a bit more Lampard-y than Gerrard-y.
Yeah, yeah. But definitely, I like the Michael Ballack comparison. We're not leaving the pressure off, are we? Is he more like Gerrard? Is he Lampard? Is he like?
We don't want to get involved in a debate about Lampard and Gerrard. It might end up that he never plays. That's your take on him. Let's hear his take on his performance. He spoke to the BBC after the game.
To be honest, I thought he'd missed, and then it felt like it took ages to loop into the goal. So yeah, I told you I wanted to try and score more goals for Dortmund and for England last year, and you know, to get in the right position. It was a brilliant ball from Shorey, and I was just there to kind of flick it away, and yeah, really proud moment for me.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So Bellingham on target and four others, because Saka obviously scored two goals, but no need for Harry Kane so far. He just played a supporting role. It was good to see.
I thought this was a really, really good performance from Kane. Even though he didn't score, he was completely integral to so much that England did. He put in the very good little cross for Sterling's goal. He also, I believe, created Rashford's goal. He was involved in everything good that England were doing. What I really liked about Kane's performance is that I feel like this England team often stands or falls by the extent to which they can get runners to go beyond Kane. Like, if Kane's isolated up top by himself, England can look a bit one-dimensional, whereas yesterday they had Bellingham going on beyond Kane, they had Saka and Sterling either side, and all of a sudden England have got a real big threat there. And Kane is so good if you can drop back, play those passes through, drop out wide, get across it, and that kind of thing for other players in the box. It's very difficult to defend against. So I thought he was fantastic yesterday, even if he didn't get on the score sheet, but I'm sure he'll be able to do that in the next few games.
Just a quick word for Harry Maguire. Played a key role in a couple of goals, hit the bar, came off prematurely because he was feeling ill. But in terms of, you know, the pre-tournament narrative, it was very much focused on why is he there? It's you know, Gareth Southgate sticking to the old tried and tested. But that would have been a performance that gave him great confidence, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it was a performance that probably took away that narrative for most people. You know, I'm sure there'll be people who are watching the next game ready to jump on him if he makes a mistake. But I thought, look, it does come down to loyalty with Southgate, but loyalty is based on trust, and trust is based on performance and personality and character and everything that Southgate's seen from him over the past 5 years. And he's been one of England's best players over those 5 years, and his performance, you know, his form for Man United over the last 12 months has been poor, really poor. But his performances for England have remained good, with perhaps the exception of one mistake against Germany. I thought he was really good yesterday, not just the aerial threat in the opposition box, setting up Saka's first goal, but hitting the bar himself. But just the way he was sort of on the front foot, breaking things down, passing the ball out of defence, played a big part in the first goal in that regard. And I thought he looked really good. And look, people will rightly say, well, he didn't look so good for the first Iranian goal, but he was substituted seconds later feeling ill, which I think suggests there was some kind of mitigation. So I thought he was really good. And to be honest, I felt they were all really good. I would give Mason Mount a shout out if we had time, because I think he's another one who was a real unsung hero yesterday. I think his presence in midfield as well, whether you call it a 10 or as one of the three in midfield, is questionable, just because he moved around so much and was all over the place, linked the play really well. So I thought there was I thought pretty much everybody played really well, including the subs.
I think what Maguire's performance shows yesterday is that maybe it doesn't really matter if a player is or isn't playing well for their club.
Yeah.
You know, he came back in and looked, I mean, he wasn't perfect, but he looked like he had a level of confidence beyond what we've seen him have for Manchester United recently. I also thought exactly the same thing about Raheem Sterling. Like, Sterling not done an awful lot at Chelsea. Frankly, didn't do an awful lot at City in his last year or two there. But he was England's best player at the Euros last summer. And yesterday, I thought he was exactly the same player he was at the Euros. He was fantastic. And so maybe we don't need to worry quite as much as we thought about whether guys are playing well or not for their clubs.
And you made the point about Germany earlier. To me, that's a German trait. It's having a system that works, players that you know work in that system. And you've seen in the past people like Miroslav Klose come to life at tournaments, Lukas Podolski having had a quiet season, or Thomas Müller even having had a quiet season at club level, really coming to life at tournaments. We've seen that again and again. And to me, when there's so much noise about, oh yeah, but he's not playing well for his club, but if Gareth Southgate sees enough in them in training to feel like he can trust them, I think we should be a bit more trustful of him in that regard.
On the issue of confidence, someone who doesn't suffer with that problem is obviously Jack Grealish, and he spoke to The Athletic's David Ornstein about his celebration, which was a tribute to Finlay, a Manchester City supporter who has cerebral palsy.
Jack, your first World Cup goal, you must be absolutely buzzing.
No, yeah, over the moon. You know, something that means a lot to me. And obviously to get that first goal in a World Cup in my first game was a dream come true. And yeah, hopefully, you know, us as a team can just kick on from here now.
That celebration, Jack, that must have meant a lot to you.
Yeah, of course. You know, obviously I got on really well with him, Finlay, when I met him 6 weeks ago, and I promised him that I'd do a celebration for him when I score. So luckily for him, you know, it come at a World Cup today.
But is it fair to say that we've left the best till last almost with Bukayo Saka and his performance, the way that he just seemed to carry his club form into international form? It was great to see, and obviously he's part of the heartbeat of the side, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he's certainly become that. And you know, there was a certain debate before the game about whether he would start, whether Foden would start. I'm sure if James Maddison had been fit, some people would have wanted him to start. But I mean, Bukayo Saka started on the right side and was, I thought he was brilliant. Not just the two goals, but which were so well taken, but just the confidence, energy that he plays with, and as well as, you know, a considerable amount of skill. He was, I thought he was brilliant, and the way he just takes his foot, he just seems completely untroubled by expectation, pressure, what he went through at the Euros with missing that penalty. I've never seen things like that sort of just wash off a player as much as they seem to with him. Maybe it's because he's so young, but you would certainly forgive a young player for having cowered a bit after what he went through at the Euros, or you would expect ups and downs in performance, or even ups and downs within matches. And he never seemed to get that with Saka. He just seems to be this supremely confident, supremely joyful player. I love watching him, and I certainly love I've loved watching for Arsenal this season. It's fantastic to see him take that form to the World Cup stage, not because it's necessarily a step up in quality from the Premier League, but it's a step up in pressure in a less familiar environment. We've seen so many players, not least English players, struggle to make that adjustment onto the World Cup stage. He went on there yesterday and just looked like he owned it.
What's the plan of action for England now, Jack?
So England's next game is Friday evening against the USA. I don't know if they will make any changes or not. I've been thinking about that, and I think, given how well they played yesterday, I mean, it's possible that Southgate might want to get a few... I mean, if Kyle Walker's fit again, maybe he'll come back in. Maybe he will want to give another... You know, see a bit more of Phil Foden, or maybe Rashford, perhaps. But I don't know. I suspect he will probably keep the same team. I think it doesn't really make any sense to make changes. And if they won that game, then maybe they can make changes for the Wales game.
This is the Athletic Football Podcast with me, Adam Leventhal, alongside Jack Pitt-Brook and Ollie Kay, our England writers. Now, we mentioned it a little bit earlier on, just before kickoff, the Iranians booed their country's national anthem, opposing the country's hardline clerical regime and demanding freedom for women. Ahead of the game, our producer, Abby Patterson, spoke to an Iranian fan, Sahir, who explained why she decided to protest.
I'm here to support Iran. Iran as in the people of Iran, dying on the streets every day. So I'm only here to amplify their voices and nothing else. So I'll do anything throughout the match to be their voice.
And you're not alone in trying to do this?
I am not. We're a group of like 20, 30 people, friends, and we are ready to chant all the way. And at minute 22, we're going to say her name, Mahsa Amini, because she was only 22 when she was brutally killed.
And is it just chanting you're doing? We got some placards?
We have placards, and we actually got them through. So they're in the stadium now that I'm outside. I'm going to meet them right now. Yes, it says Woman, Life, Freedom and Mahsa Amini. So I'm sure it's going to be good. Actually, I don't care if Iran loses, if Iran wins. I'm all here for Iranian people out there right now in Mahabad, in Saqqez, in Kurdistan. They're dying and I'm there for them.
And how big is the World Cup going to be in Iran itself, do you know?
At the moment, I know that people are boycotting it and they don't want Iran to win. And they're like cheering for England, cheering for United States and Wales. So, no, it's not. But I know that if we lose, there are going to be big crowds out there on the streets. Because they have sent people from themselves, the regime, to chant, to show a normal face, to put a normal face on Iran's regime, which is not. Nothing is normal. It's a revolution. And we have to silence them. They're here to silence us, but we're not going to let them.
So Abby, who spoke to Sahir, is alongside us this morning. You're also at the game. What was the feeling like when that happened and that there was booing and the players weren't singing the anthem?
Yeah, I was walking into the stadium as the anthems were going on. I had spent a lot of time outside trying to establish what was happening with the ticketing confusion. And so as I walked in, I was just overwhelmed by the amount of booing that I heard for the anthem. I knew there was going to be the protest. As I say, we've just heard from Sahir, who told me that, you know, she didn't care about the result. It was all about using the platform of the World Cup to make a stand, to make a protest. And that's in quite stark contrast to what England ended up backing out of.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the England situation, Jack. Obviously, the One Love armband, I think we can call it a fiasco because a lot of people have been disappointed about what happened. It has also been highlighted as well that the rules didn't change. The spirit of the rules could have been interpreted differently by FIFA, and they could have had the option to say, no, okay, go ahead, but they didn't. But I think a lot of people are disappointed that England didn't try and do what the Iranians did and make a stand. Do you think that that's fair criticism?
I can understand why a lot of people feel that way. And lots of people do feel like England and the other European FAs have caved on this point and have failed to make a stand. I think that's a completely legitimate point of view. That's not exactly how I see it. My own view is that by threatening yellow cards for players who did this, FIFA effectively made it impossible. Because realistically, England, when no team is going to put themselves in a situation where they've got their captain on a booking all the time. Like, it's just, it's unrealistic that any team who would be actively trying to win the World Cup would play with one hand behind their backs like that. So, of course, I understand that they haven't, you know, they've ended up doing nothing, but I think that's not entirely their fault.
There's also been issues with the Belgium shirt, that being censored as well. I mean, Ollie, from your take on this, basically what we're saying is just get back in your box and stop trying to bring issues into the game as far as FIFA are concerned. And are you disappointed that everyone's just towing the line? People aren't making a stand. They aren't using this platform. Ultimately, you know, This is the chance to actually try and engender some sort of change, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think they've succeeded in using the platform to try to make a stand, and FIFA haven't let them. Look, they could have defied it. They could have, you know, England and Holland and Wales and all the other countries, they could have gone into the game and with their captains on a yellow card. I mean, God, you know, that would have been powerful. It would have been a powerful illustration of FIFA's lack of tolerance for solidarity with the LGBTQ community. I just felt extremely disappointed by it. I think it's certainly tempting to say the FA and the other FAs could have handled it a lot better, and I think they could, but I don't think they're the bad guys here. I think FIFA's failure to engage with the associations from when it was first raised 2 months ago, and then their sort of counter proposal that was just rushed out a couple of days ago, and then the idea of threatening a yellow card.
It's also become quite clear this week where the power lies in that relationship between FIFA and the Qatari organisers, and that I'm sure is why FIFA are progressing with this policy, which you might is a kind of asymmetrical depoliticization in which Infantino tells everyone else, keep politics out of football, keep politics out of football. You can't have the One Love armband, you can't mention political causes, you don't even criticize Qatar, don't do anything to bring any politics into this. While at the same time, this is obviously a nakedly political event. Like, look at the first game. Infantino was sat up there with Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, the Emir of Qatar, Erdogan, the president of Turkey, was there. General Sisi, the president of Egypt, was there. The whole thing is, I mean, if this isn't political, then what is? And yet, for Infantino and FIFA, nobody else is allowed to do politics, only them.
Gareth Southgate seemed to try and sort of kick this armband issue into the long grass after the game. And I think, and we spoke about it with Adam Crafton on yesterday's episode, that the feeling was once the football started, people will start forgetting about it. And obviously that would be Gianni Infantino's view, and it may well be a lot of fans' views as well. They might just think, look, come on, I'm just into the football, I'm not into the politics. But do you think that this will just simply fly away and disappear? I mean, we've seen other issues with journalists not allowed into games with rainbow T-shirts on. I went to the Senegal-Netherlands game yesterday, and there's a special flag interpretation unit.
What's that about?
I think, and I spoke to the guys there, and they were talking about the fact that it's down to size and things like that. Size matters for the flags, apparently, at this World Cup. But there is clearly a policing of messaging, and I just feel that this isn't going to disappear, is it?
It's not going to disappear, and I think the more it's controlled, the more it's policed and policed aggressively, and the messaging is sort of dictated, controlled by FIFA and the Qataris, I think the more it will not go away, because the story won't go away, and people will feel more and more strongly about it. To be honest, we've not seen this kind of demonstration by fans at previous World Cups. We've not seen the great deal of rainbow T-shirts or banners and things, sometimes. But I think the reason it's such a major issue here is because homosexuality is criminalised in Qatar, and that has brought it under the scrutiny. FIFA and Qatar are not handling the scrutiny well at all. They're handling it extremely badly, and it's just going to increase the issue. I don't think I'm sure we'll ask again about the armband ahead of Friday's game. I'm sure other captains and managers will be asked about it. I imagine the armband question is going to go away because it has been resolved. Totally unsatisfactory way, but it's been resolved. But I don't think we've heard about the last of it in general, or about fans and flags and clothing and so on. I think it's just going to not go away at all.
At one point I'd like to just make on, you talk about, FIFA trying to get away from any political messaging and trying to police branding political messages. Loads of Iranian fans turned up yesterday with T-shirts saying "Women, Life, Freedom." So there is a clear disparity and lack of continuity from FIFA about what is a political message.
We will, of course, continue to cover the issues off the field as well as on it. And let's just mark the game between the USA and Wales yesterday. This is the take of The Athletic's Paul Tenorio.
Realistically, the US is walking away from this game disappointed. The first half was a really strong performance. They had a 1-0 lead through a nice little movement between Christian Pulisic and Tim Weah. Pulisic getting on the ball in midfield off of control by Josh Sargent, driving at the Wales back line, finding that little bit of space to find Tim Weah's run in behind, and Weah with a clean finish to the outside of his right foot. And the U.S. was going into the break really feeling confident, feeling like they had a chance to get 3 points. And with 10 minutes left in the game, that's where it looked it was headed. But the World Cup is decided by the thinnest of margins. And in this case, it was just 2 seconds that changed the game. A ball cut back across the box, Walker Zimmerman's decision to leave his feet, and Gareth Bale's clever movement to get his legs and his arms in front of Zimmerman, who had already committed. Gareth Bale had just 2 touches in the box all night, drawing the penalty and scoring the penalty.
Well, you can read much more from our US team of writers, including Paul on The Athletic. Thank you very much to Ollie and to Jack for your time this morning. Don't forget, there is all the best in-depth writing on The Athletic. Some other articles to just point you in the direction of. Chris Woff, back at home, his deep dive into Newcastle's new signing, Australian striker Karen Goll. And Adam Crafton, back at this World Cup on the day that Lionel Messi starts his tournament. He takes an in-depth look into the links between the Argentine and Saudi Arabia. If you want to get involved and you want to read those articles and much, much more, subscribe to The Athletic for £1 per month for the next 12 months. That's our best offer of the year. Go to theathletic.com/footballpod. We will be back from here in Doha tomorrow.
The Athletic.